This week's Tribcast is sponsored by Texas Dental Association. On behalf of over 8,500 member dentists, TDA supports the common sense patient protections in SB 384 for clear aligner patients. Find out more at tda.org. And Methodist Healthcare Ministries is committed to health equity, striving to create more fair and just opportunities for all to thrive. Learn more at mhm.org.
Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for Friday, May 5th. My name is Matthew Watkins, Managing Editor for News and Politics for the Tribune. And we are coming down the home stretch of the legislative session. There are 8,343 bills filed so far this year in Texas legislative session. And most of those will die not by being voted down by a chamber or a committee, but by missed deadlines for bills to be voted out by the chamber or the committee. And next week, those deadlines are starting to come. We'll have May 4th, the deadline for House committees to vote out bills, House bills at least, and May 11th, the deadline for the full chamber of the House to vote out House bills. So basically, it's crunch time. It's time for bills to kind of get through or start failing. Joining us to talk about this week is two political reporters for the Tribune, Patrick Svitek. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And James Barragán. Hey, James.
Hello.
So, you know, I think the big question that many of us have coming into this last month, the last few weeks of the legislative session is it all going to fall apart? And are we going to have a special session forced? There's a long list of Dan Patrick priorities that he, you know, is still waiting to see come out of the House. And there are, you know, must pass bills, the budget sunset legislation, which we can get into and explain a little bit, that he can sort of, you know, for a lack of a better term, hold hostage and force a special session if they don't come through. And he has made very clear to us and to the world that he is willing to do so if he doesn't see some of these priorities come through. Patrick, let's start with you. What are some of those priorities, and what stand out to you as the ones that he's kind of highlighting the most?
Well, in the lieutenant governor's own words, his highest priorities right now are his property tax relief plan and his power grid reforms that he's proposed. I mean, he has explicitly said that, you know, those are worth going to a special session over if they can't come together on them in the next few weeks. And so those are the two major issues to watch, I think, as far as Dan Patrick and potential special sessions are concerned. And in both of those situations, there's not a lot of hope, I think, for consensus at the moment. We've gone over the property tax, you know, dispute between the two chambers repeatedly. They're both dug in, I think, on their respective positions, and Dan Patrick has especially dug in on his position. And then when it comes to his priority grid reform bills, Senate Bill 6 and Senate Bill 7, I don't believe Senate Bill 6 as of this hour has gotten a hearing in the House. Senate Bill 7 did get a hearing this week, but it was not a very, successful hearing for the bill's prospects going forward. It was left pending, and Chairman seemed critical of it. So that's where we're at on those two issues.
So these two issues, like you said, they are not, they seem to be farther apart. Would it be safe to say that they're farther apart on property taxes than the grid? Or is that, do you say they're equally kind of split on those two?
I would say that maybe they're closer on property taxes, because I think that they actually maybe could come to a consensus on property taxes, just because, like, the governor has put so much emphasis on it. He wants to deliver the biggest tax cut, which, you know, asterisk, and, you know, we've all fact checked with that can't really be the biggest tax cut in state history. But, you know, they want to do it. Like, they do want to. They just have different approaches for how to do it. And I think we're going to see in the last couple of weeks them trying to come together and see if they can hammer something out. But the grid thing that Patrick is talking about, like, that seems like a no-go for the House. And really, it's Patrick, who's the only one pushing for that, for the natural gas plant incentivization. The House wants something to do with it. And I don't know if the governor has really weighed in on that, although, of course, the grid is you know a key issue for him. He's very interested in making sure it's up and running.
Patrick, give us a brief rundown of what it is that Dan Patrick wants from the grid, and where that might, why that might run into a hitch in the house.
Well, I would maybe defer to our energy reporter, Foxall, and all the specifics of the legislation. But I think broadly speaking, it's fair to say that Patrick is backing a suite of proposals that would incentivize the construction of more natural gas capacity in Texas. And there is, you know, there is real disagreement on you know, how much more reliable that actually makes the grid, questions environmental impact, questions even from members of Dan Patrick's own party about whether that amounts to a distortion of the free market, which is, you know, traditionally a conservative principle is staying out of the free market and letting it work its will. And so it's, you know, these proposals have really encountered all these political cross currents. And that, I think, has contributed to the really, you know, uncertain state that they're in right now.
It's also like there's some politics at play here, though, right, Patrick? I mean, because what the lieutenant governor has said is like he doesn't like renewables. Like the wind is great, wind energy and renewables are great when the wind is blowing and the sun is out. But when it's not, like that doesn't work. And that's why we need dispatchable energy like natural gas. I think there are some politics here. But like you're saying, and like Emily has reported, the experts say, hey, maybe this isn't the best way to go about it. And there are like other solutions that, you know, the legislature has worked on over the last 2 years on this that, you know, I would say maybe experts consider a little bit more serious than this. But I guess my whole point is like there are some politics here on the energy talks.
Yeah, and to go back to Abbott's position in all this, that's been, you know, the subject of a lot of political intrigue. I mean, after his reelect last year, and as Dan Patrick was really ramping up his focus on this as a legislative issue, Abbott was notably quiet. And then in his inaugural address in January, he did come out and basically side with Dan Patrick on this issue, generally speaking. He mentioned it again in his State of the State speech about a month later, but he did not designate it an emergency item. He didn't, you know, signal that it's the highest priority for him. And so, right, you know, I don't think Abbott is particularly invested in this issue this session. He has much higher priorities. And, you know, Patrick, I think, is kind of on an island among the three of them when it comes to being very vocal about this issue.
Yeah, and like ERCOT and PUC, I can't remember which one has said it, but they want to be like agnostic on like what the source is. They just want the grid up and running, right? Like they don't necessarily want to say like it's got to be dispatchable energy. They want it to, they just want it to be working, and they're like agnostic as to what makes it work.
Well, and we did have some news this week coming from a state report, basically indicating that, you know,
we're in trouble.
Yeah, that demand might not keep up with, or sorry, that supply might not keep up with demand in this situation. And then I kind of raised my eyebrows because I believe the next day Governor Abbott tweeted out, you know, that he was holding a meeting with, you know, leaders involved in the natural gas industry, you know, about this situation. And at that table was Dan Patrick, not present at that table, Dade Phelan. I wonder, maybe I'm reading too much into that, Patrick, but that felt like something of a signal there.
Sure. I think Abbott at least wants to be physically and figuratively at the table for those discussions, as you just pointed out. You know, the sense I get is that Abbott isn't necessarily, like explicitly against what Dan Patrick is pushing, but Abbott is someone who tried to kind of close the door on this issue after the 2021 session. He, you know, Dan Patrick did not let him close the door on it. And so Dan Patrick keeps, I think, dragging out this issue in Abbott's view. And so Abbott, I think, just wants resolution on this. And Patrick keeps extending the shelf life of it legislatively and politically. And so I think Abbott is just eager for some kind of solution to close this chapter of his governorship. And it may not be that he explicitly opposes what Dan Patrick is pushing, but he wants to be at the table and he wants to figure out a timely resolution.
And to be fair to the lieutenant governor, I mean, the state of the grid does seem precarious.
Yeah.
So like there is, and of course he's taking it, he's putting his politics on it, which is that he supports natural gas plant incentivization. But the concern is there from the lieutenant governor and from the governor, and quite frankly, from all of us who still have PTSD
yeah.
in 2021.
Yeah, well, I just, you know, it would be an interesting scenario where if we had a special session forced over this, you know, yes. going into the summer, that period
and
where
like
we are projecting. Yeah, exactly. I wonder if that would change the dynamics of the political conversation. In any way. All right, let's talk briefly about property taxes. Patrick, as you mentioned, we have kind of talked about this quite a bit. Senate proposal seems to be, you know, largely based around raising the homestead exemption for all homeowners, as well as particularly, I guess, more for seniors, in addition to pushing a bunch of money, you know, over $5 billion toward buying down school property taxes. The House, on the other side, wants to limit appraisal growth, appraisal caps. They also want to put billions of dollars towards the public school system and in those property taxes. So the issue seems to be more around whether it's a homestead exemption or an appraisal cap. You know, we've heard, and our reporter Josh Fechter has done a lot of reporting on some of the challenges and concerns being raised about appraisal caps and how, you know, that might disincentivize from people from, you know, ever moving out of their house, and could in part, you know, raise property tax, property values in that regard. I guess my question here is, it doesn't really seem like there's much progress being made on this discussion. Is there any sign of compromise or you know, other proposals out there that y'all are seeing?
Not yet. I know that the Senate bill was referred to a committee in the House in recent days, but that's not necessarily the sign of real momentum. We'd have to wait and see whether it's even going to get a hearing in said committee. So I think folks are still waiting to see if there is a compromise in sight there. Dan Patrick has been, you know, they both have disagreements in this situation, but Dan Patrick has been the one who's been more immovable, saying he's not willing to compromise on appraisal caps. You know, in contrast, you have Dade Phelan, who says our legislation includes appraisal caps, but I'm not closing the door on homestead exemption. So I think, you know, Phelan is the one who has already shown a little more flexibility on this issue and maybe the path toward a compromise. But Patrick is the one who just appears to be more dug in.
I have continued to watch this and speculate about, you know, does Phelan appear to be digging in his heels as some kind of negotiating tactic in order to pull anything out? Because I think a lot of us have looked at this and been a little bit confused about his stance on here. But I guess my question is, you know, what is it that Phelan wants? If he is, you know, preparing for negotiations, what is at the top of his list that he wants to see happen in these last few weeks?
Yeah,
he's got a lot. Yeah, I mean, he's got a lot, and it's sometimes he has priority bills that he's designated, and they haven't been as attention grabbing as Dan Patrick's priority bills, which tend to touch on more of like the, you know, red meat debates of the day. Yep. But, you know, as I said, Phelan's outlined a number of over a dozen, I think, priority bills. And so one of the things that I think is striking in the final few weeks here is that when it comes to that kind of horse trading, you know, arena that we're entering into, there are just so many active, you know, issues on the table, so many different priorities that each of these guys are focused on that do not line up with the other chamber. And so there's just a lot of proposals in play when it comes to thinking about the end game of this legislative session.
Yeah, I mean, I think like some of the things that, for example, the speaker wants that the lieutenant governor hasn't really talked about or expressed any interest in is like the extension of Medicaid coverage for low-income mm-hmm. mothers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that they did last session, got it to 12 months in the House and then bumped it back down to 6 months in the Senate. The House is back, says they want it. You know, the sales tax exemption for feminine hygiene products and diapers, that's something that the House wants that the Senate hasn't really talked about. And it's like, you know, more like, you know, things that like can touch people's lives in a very real way. And then there's also things that are, you know, kind of snooze fest to us, like infrastructure funds, mm-hmm. but very important, as our mm-hmm. regional reporters have reported, because the water infrastructure in the state is not great.
Yep.
And so those are some of the things that could be, you know, horse part of the bargaining chips and the horse trading in the end. The other thing that sort of we've noted in our reporting is that, you know, some of these like infrastructure funds, sure, they're not as sexy to write about, but they're also very necessary, and I think would be a hard thing to kill, because if you are Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and you're killing infrastructure bonds, or you're killing, say, another priority like the Bishop Evans Act to give death benefits to National Guard troops on the border, like, that's not a great look. So it puts him in a tough position, but, you know, the Lieutenant Governor is never scared to be in a tough position.
Indeed, indeed. You know, Patrick, you and I started at the Tribune at a, you know, basically, I think the same month or the during the same legislative session, at least. And we have been through a few of these. James, you have too. And there is never a time, it's usually in May, when people start freaking out about how there's going to be a special session. Of course, many times there are special sessions, including last session. So I don't mean to completely downplay that that problem. But does it feel more dire? Does it feel especially unusual for the two chambers to be separate right now on these issues? Or does, is that just kind of the way things go in a Texas legislature, particularly a Texas legislature where Dan Patrick is the lieutenant governor and likes to do these kind of public negotiations?
Yeah, I will say, you know, the sessions that I've been here since 2015 onward, it has been more of the norm than not the norm that, you know, in the final month, things look dire. You know, some of the chambers are apart on big, the two chambers are apart on some of the big issues. But this session, even by that standard, this session does feel a little different for a couple of reasons. I think the first reason is what I said several minutes ago, which is there are just so many priority issues on the table that are unresolved with 3 weeks to go. So you just have just so many issues in play. And number two, I mean, I think the relationship among the big three is probably the worst it's been in a long time. I mean, obviously we know Dan Patrick and Dave Phelan don't have a good relationship. You have Dan Patrick, you know, calling Dave Phelan California Dade, name calling him, and, you know, which, you know, to us, like at this point, just because we know Dan Patrick, that doesn't really faze us. But I mean, you know, compare it to how, you know, Patrick treated Strauss, which is very critical, but, you know, never would whip out an insulting nickname like that. Right. So we just should pause and take in the level of acrimony required to do something like that. And then you have Abbott, who, you know, I don't know. You know, Abbott has been very quiet recently. You know, even on the issue that he's championed all session, school choice, he's been relatively quiet on it. It's, you know, they're not having the big three breakfasts, you know, anymore. You know, we've learned through reporting. You know, and I don't even know what the state of the Abbott and Patrick relationship is. You know, I've heard that they haven't had a lot of contact this session. So, you know, I think those are some of the factors that make this a uniquely perilous final month of this session.
I will say, first of all, that I need to defend my home state. California is not always
that was a compliment.
I'm already seeing all your emails and your tweets, but I got to stand up for my home state. Secondly, I will say your point is very good, Patrick, in that, like, there were so many priorities. You know, I was doing a hobby hour talk with a bunch of other reporters from across the state, and Gromer Jeffers of the DMN noted, like, there are now 30 priorities for the lieutenant governor, plus the 20 from the House Speaker. It's a lot of things to get done. But, you know, I'll say also, it's still May 5th. We've got a little more than 3 weeks. A lot of things are in conference committee, so we can get a lot of these things done. And the thing that Patrick is pointing out, like, the big three may be fighting amongst each other. I don't see that same animosity from, like, the actual members. Like, the members don't hate each other. It's just the big three that hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I wouldn't say hate each other. Maybe they just don't like each other. I don't know. I'm not in their inner heads.
Yeah.
But it's clear that, you know, Phelan and Patrick don't like each other. But, you know, we got 3 weeks. So let's see what happens. I'm not canceling my summer travel yet, which I have not made, except for one wedding.
You know, I think that's a good point. The counterpoint to that, you know, as it relates to House Senate rank and file relationships is, you know, the Senate has just become such a one man show with the stranglehold that Dan Patrick has on it. So, you know, to me, you know, I think to a certain point, it's like, you know, why does it matter if the Senate, you know, if Brandon Creighton and Brad Buckley have a good relationship, if Dan Patrick's the one who's going to call the shots in the Senate? I mean, I do agree with you that you don't see a lot of animosity between the rank and file in the two chambers. And, you know, and that's great. But I have to wonder, at the end of the day, just given that the Senate is a one-man show, how much does that matter?
Yep.
Fair enough. All right, let's pause for a second here from our sponsors.
Raise Your Hand, Texas. No matter what an education voucher is called, the policy is the same. Vouchers divert public funds to private schools and vendors. Find out more at raiseyourhandtexas.org. And Texas Hospital Association. Don't flatline Texas healthcare. Will Texas protect its patients? Dismantling hospital services does nothing for patients or the price of healthcare. In fact, it hurts everyone. Find out more at THA.org.
Okay, so one other thing that I've noticed about, you know, regarding Dan Patrick's threat of a special session is that he brings up two issues that are not particularly hot button issues in and of themselves. I mean, you know, the grid, I think most Texans tend to agree that they would like the grid to be functioning well. You know, there is some disagreement as to how to go about that, of course. But really, I mean, honestly, I would say most of the disagreement is in the Capitol. I don't like hear a lot of people coming up to me and being like, should this be, you know, gas plants or whatever? And then, you know, the other one being property taxes, a very, you know, property taxes are deeply unpopular in the state.
Right.
But then we have these other issues, you know, related to universities, the canceling of tenure, DEI issues. You have school choice, a very, very controversial issue kind of across the state. And then all these LGBTQ bills that are coming up. I mean, the LGBTQ bills, particularly, you know, as we record this, the House is in session. They have not started debating the bill to ban puberty blockers or hormone therapies for children. But I think we all probably expect, barring some other kind of point of order that, you know, procedural challenge that blocked that from getting passed earlier this week, we expect that to get through the House today.
Yeah.
But, you know, the school choice and the university tenure topics are much more in much more precarious positions.
Yeah.
Do we see the fact that those haven't been brought up as, I mean, do those two items have a potential to blow up the session, I guess is my question.
I think, I mean, I'll take the contrarian opinion on the school choice thing, because I think that with so much political capital exerted by the governor on this, there is still a likelihood that something gets done. Like, you got to think that he's working behind the scenes with some of these rural members who are opposed to it to get some kind of limited education savings account passed there, get it over the hump, because otherwise he's taking the L, and he's taking the L on like a huge thing that he's like been crisscrossing the state on. Mm-hmm. So I still see a likelihood of that passing. In terms of like DEI stuff, I think that's a little bit harder because and tenure stuff, because yeah. You know, tenure is super important to these public universities, which we have a lot of like really great research universities, which the governor is super interested in. Mm-hmm. He loves to tout how many tier one research institutions we have. Mm-hmm. And getting rid of tenure, as our reporter Kate McGee has already written about, is already having an impact on how professors who are up for tenure are thinking about when they consider coming to a public institution here in Texas.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And Dave Thielen said at TribFest back in the fall that, you know, I thought a pretty decent argument around this political debate of like, if you get rid of tenure, the people you might be putting the most at risk are the conservative professors.
Oh, that's right.
And so, yeah, I agree that that seems to be one, both because of the impact and the arguments being made against it, that seems to have a tall hill to climb there.
I was just going to say, we covered this in our story that just posted before we got on this podcast, but the anti-DEI bill seems like it has a much better chance making it to Abbott's desk than the anti-tenure bill, just because we already saw the House kind of go on the record against these DEI policies in a budget rider or a budget amendment. You know, I think there was an effort to strip out an anti-DEI part of the budget, and the House voted to keep it in. So we kind of already got a temperature of the House on that issue. And we know Abbott generally, you know, is opposed to these DEI efforts on college campuses based on the public statements he's made over the past several, past few months. Tenure, though, as you point out, I think is going to be more uncertain. Like you said, Phelan has said he opposes it. We haven't heard much from Abbott on it. When Dan Patrick first raised the idea over a year ago, Abbott was very noncommittal about it. And then, you know, Abbott, you know, obviously has a close relationship with these universities through the regency appoints. And I think he is, we've seen time and time again how Abbott is very protective of some of his highest profile appointees and doesn't like putting them in political harm's way. And I think that, you know, that's what the 10-year bill has the potential to do.
You know, you mentioned school choice. I want to go back to that really quickly because there was something that I read in that article that y'all just published that I had somehow missed, which is that there's money in both chambers' budgets for some kind of a school choice proposal, right?
Right.
Which that was an interesting little tidbit of information, which suggested to me that, yeah, maybe there is room for some kind of compromise along that line.
Well, yeah, and I think that's because, like, the House, you know, the Speaker has said, like, if you ask, you know, our 150 members what school choice means, you're going to get 150 different answers. So there could be the folks in there, and there could be a majority that is interested in having some type of school choice program, but they don't agree on what it is. So the House, I think, as a buffer, was like, okay, the governor is very interested in this. Like, let's put it in there so that if it does pass, we have money to do this with. But they just haven't come to terms on the actual bill, on what an education savings account thing compromise would look like. And so that's the difficult part of this. How do they come to that compromise, and how limited in scope? And I think it will be limited in scope just because of, like, the massive resistance that there is.
Yeah. On the LGBTQ issues, that was obviously a dramatic moment in the House earlier this week. You had the bill coming up for debate, protesters, you know, getting loud, disrupting the proceedings, immediately being removed from the chamber, many being removed from the Capitol itself, two people being arrested. At least one of those folks had their charges sort of immediately dropped by a magistrate judge. And then, you know, a pretty effective point of order, you know, that yeah, raised basically a misspelling on a bill analysis, causing the bill to be sent back to committee in order to correct that error. They moved quickly on it. They seem very intent on passing this bill, the leadership in the House. You know, I think there were some folks, we always like to bring up the old, you know, Dade Phelan comment about the LGBTQ community. There had, I think, been some hope among members of that community that the House might be a sort of last,
like, a buffer
for that kind of stuff. I mean, that does not seem to have come to fruition, Jay.
And just for all the tinfoil hats out there, that was a cough that Matthew did, not a laugh. So, you know, keep your emails to yourselves. But yeah, I think, you know, he's got to go with the membership of the House, which is the way he has said he would run the House. The House has become much more conservative on these issues, and particularly on issues like Senate Bill 15, which is the participation of transgender athletes in sports. I think that's it's a much more difficult issue to really get into. And there are people who traditionally would support LGBT rights who say, maybe we've got to think about this one. It deals with the advantages that a transgender person would have in competing in sports. The other one, too, dealing with, you know, the treatment that kids can get, it does. And transgender rights and transgender healthcare is so new to the general population that when people say, oh, well, they're mutilating them or something, it is very effective. And and so then the defender of those rights are having to be on the defensive and teaching and trying to educate about what these puberty blockers and hormone therapy are. And so it puts people in difficult positions, I would say. And so, yeah, I mean, it hasn't been the buffer that certainly it was when Speaker Strauss was there, when he was saying, you know, I don't want the blood of kids, transgender kids, on my hands. And so effectively, yeah, it has been much more welcoming to these kinds of bills than perhaps would have been expected a couple of years ago. I don't know, Patrick, what you think?
Yeah, and I would say from Phelan's perspective, I still find it very remarkable that on both the college trans athlete ban and then this ban on gender affirming care for trans minors, that the authors went out and got majority chamber support for their proposal very early on in the session, I would say. And so, you know, from Phelan's perspective, you're a Republican speaker. This is a Republican bill. It has enough people on the record for it to pass. How do you not advance it? And maybe leadership was involved in, you know, corralling majority support for those two proposals. But I do find it interesting that they were able to get majority support, you know, all Republicans very early on in the session. And so, you know, that puts it in a pretty, you know, politically natural position for Phelan to say, you know, these are Republican bills, you know, they have majority support, they could pass. I mean, it kind of eliminates any excuse for him not to let them get to a vote, right?
He's never addressed those, you know, he made those comments to Evan Smith in his podcast, 2019, before he was the speaker, saying, you know, it's 2019, we should stop with the gay bashing. He's never addressed that, and we've certainly tried to ask him about it, but this is sort of where the political atmosphere is in the House now.
Right. Yeah. You think about how it was the 2017 session where the bathroom bill kind of blew things up and it became chaotic. I mean, it's
and
hard.
You had the flipping of those 12 seats by the Democrats.
Right.
A lot based on, you know, some of these very controversial topics like sanctuary cities, like the bathroom bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine that bill not passing the House in this legislature.
I
hadn't
considered that, but yeah, it would definitely have a better chance, I think, in the makeup of the House.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about one non-legislative thing. We had news this week of Colin Allred, the U.S. rep, Democratic U.S. rep out of Dallas, announcing his bid to challenge Senator Ted Cruz for Senate in 2024. That is the first kind of high profile official declaration in that race. We have heard, you know, the possibility, maybe even likelihood of Roland Gutierrez, the state senator who represents Uvalde and other parts of South Texas, possibly getting in that race as well. Patrick, tell us a little bit about that launch and what we heard from Allred.
Yeah, Allred had been looking at this for, you know, months and months. I mean, even before the November 2022 election. You know, he was able to kind of keep it under the radar, but then there was stories that leaked out earlier this week that said his launch was imminent. And of course it ultimately came. And so, you know, he is probably, you know, realistically one of the best candidates that Democrats could get to run for this seat right now, given the monumental challenge of a Democrat winning statewide in Texas. You know, I think that, he's got a compelling record in that he was one of the few Democrats in recent history in Texas who flipped a seat in a really prominent, you know, nationally watched way. He was one of two Democrats to flip congressional seats in Texas in 2018 while Beto O'Rourke was running against Cruz. In Congress, you know, he is probably going to talk about his bipartisan credentials, and he has some credible things to point to on that front. He's also going to have to talk, though, about, you know, being close to Democratic leadership and, you know, voting, you know, in alignment with Nancy Pelosi and current Democratic leadership in the House. And so, you know, that congressional record is definitely going to cut both ways for him. I do think his fundraising, you know, his initial fundraising was pretty impressive. You know, his campaign announced that he raised over $2 million in the first 36 hours of his campaign. And that they raised 1.6 million of that in the first 24 hours, which would be the biggest, you know, first day for a Senate candidate this election cycle so far. I think what that tells us, that just confirms that, you know, Cruz, you know, remains a really galvanizing force for small dollar donors across the country. And I don't think Allred is going to be lacking for money in this race. And I will say he was already a pretty strong fundraiser before he got into this race. I mean, he got into this race with $2.2 million cash on hand. Cruz has had $3.3 million cash on hand. So I do think fundraising is going to be Allred's strong suit, both because of his inherent skills that he's demonstrated already and also just because of the national spotlight and hatred for Cruz among these small dollar donors.
Yeah, you know, I would say two things kind of stood out to me about his announcement. One is, as you had mentioned, he'd been kind of viewed as something of a rising star in the Texas Democratic Party. You know, all the reasons that you mentioned, he's a former Baylor football player, had a little kind of cup of coffee in the NFL.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
He
sour grapes from the A&M guy. Wow.
But, you know, it's somewhat unusual to see those rising stars actually put their hat in the ring in these races. Yeah. You know, we saw the Castros kind of be talked about for running statewide for a really long time, and they never really got around to doing it. You know, even Beto O'Rourke obviously has a very high profile now. But when he announced that race, you know, his bid to challenge Cruz the last time, I was not a particularly well-known member of Congress. And, you know, he had sort of term limited himself, you know, saying that he wouldn't, you know, would only run, I think, two terms, if I'm remembering that correctly. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Patrick. But you know, previously what you end up seeing people going to those races are like, you know, mayors who can't run for mayor anymore or some of those other things. So it did feel notable to me to see a Democrat with that prestige.
I definitely think, and this could be my Dallas bias, but I definitely think that Colin Allred is much more well known than Beto O'Rourke was at the beginning of his senatorial run in 2018 against Ted Cruz. You know, the other right? Yeah, I think so, Patrick. The other thing that's interesting to me is to have a candidate of color heading up so far a competitive or what could be a competitive Senate campaign in Texas. Colin Allred, he's got a good story. You know, went to college, did some time in the NFL, has got a law degree. He sort of speaks all the languages in terms of, like, he can get the fundraisers, he can get big donors. He's from Dallas. And you know, a candidate of color that can, and he's 40, I think 40 is how old he is. So he's part of like a younger generation that can galvanize voters that are around that age that maybe wouldn't be captivated by an older candidate. So I think he is an interesting pick, and obviously it'll be, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. I think the rollout was maybe didn't get as much flair as I expected, but that's could also be because, you know, Politico broke the news early and so it kind of fizzled out. But I am curious to see if he can continue that you know, trajectory or, you know, energy, especially as we start seeing other people jump into the mix.
Yeah, one other thing I was just going to add is that, you know, it should be noted this is a presidential election cycle in Texas, so he's not leading the ticket. You know, he is, you know, presumably Joe Biden will be leading the ticket in Texas, well, right?
You're assuming that National Democrats will play in Texas.
sure. But in any case, you know, this isn't, you know, it's a little different to compare this to Beto O'Rourke in 2018, because Beto O'Rourke was at the top of the ticket. When you're an in-state, statewide candidate at the top of the ticket, there's a little more of a burden on you to develop a distinct brand, you know, and create the wave that you want. Whereas now, you know, Colin Allred is going to be, you know, he's, you know, his chances are going to be pretty closely tied to the presidential election, because that's what's going to drag out most voters in Texas in November 2024. And so I think there is less of a burden on Allred to be necessarily some really unique, huge celebrity candidate like Beto O'Rourke was in 2018. You know, in a presidential election year, when you're running in this kind of race, you just have to be disciplined, raise the money, and you know, relatively unoffensive, I think, ideologically, and be in a good position for when the wave breaks one way or another. And, you know, I think Allred fits that bill right now.
All right. Well, it's going to be an interesting to watch. I mean, there's also a possibility, right, of an interesting primary there. I mean, do we think Gutierrez sticks with his, you know, there's been some reporting that he was looking at that seat as well.
When is his seat up, Patrick?
His state Senate seat is not up until 2026, so this would be a free shot for him.
Free shot.
I don't know why he wouldn't do it. He doesn't lose his state Senate seat. Obviously, he's been very frustrated with the state Senate and its inaction on gun restrictions after the Uvalde shooting, which happened in his district. He's a bit of an outcast in the state Senate for his efforts to move on those issues. So there's really no reason for him not to do it. And he also, you know, he's also a Hispanic Democrat from South Texas, which continues to be a point of focus for Democrats in terms of an area they need to do better in. I think Democrats, you know, Allred's from Dallas. I think Democrats believe they're doing just okay in Dallas these days. So, you know, he brings a definitely a different background and profile than Allred. And, you know, like I said, politically, the stakes are pretty, you know, there's not a lot of risk for him.
Yeah, and he has an interesting story to tell, having spent, you know, much of the past session with families of victims of the shooting in Uvalde and the work that he's done with them as well. It'll be an interesting thing to watch, but first we will need to get through this legislative session. Thank you, Patrick and James, California James, for talking us through this. And thank you to our producer, Justin. And thank you to our sponsors, the Texas Dental Association, Methodist Healthcare Ministries of South Texas, Raise Your Hand Texas, and the Texas Hospital Association. We'll talk to y'all next week.
Join us on May 5th in Midland for a conversation with experts about water infrastructure in Texas and what it will take to keep the state's water safely flowing. RSVP at texastribune.org/events.